Interpreter Foundation Roundtable. The Roundtable is one in a series that's done by Interpreter Foundation. This year's series is of the Old Testament. This is number 3, The Creation. With me in this broadcast, we have Jeff Bradshaw on the left of your screen at the bottom, Mike Parker next to him, Stephen Smoot, and then on the far right on the bottom would be me, Martin Tanner. Today's discussion is about the creation, and we have, of course, Genesis, Pearl of Great Price content there as well. The Latter-day Saints have somewhat of a unique view of the creation, which is something we don't often realize. And one of the flaws that some people have in their approach to the creation is that they try to pigeonhole or dovetail it completely into science. And I, for one, and many, many others, don't think that's the perfect approach for it. And Mike Parker is going to start us off and explain that. Let's turn the time over to you, Mike.
Thanks, Martin. I'd actually like to begin with a quote from James E. Talmadge. This is from an address that he gave in the Tabernacle in Salt Lake City in 1931. And he said, "Let us not try to wrest the scriptures in an attempt to explain away what we cannot explain. The opening chapters of Genesis and scriptures related thereto were never intended as a textbook of geology, archaeology, earth science, or man science. We do not show reverence for the scriptures when we misapply them through faulty interpretation." And that's the end of the quote. And I think that Elder Talmadge made a very, very good point there, that we understand a lot from science about how the world works, how creation works, how biology works, and there are many people who, since the age of reason and the age of enlightenment, have tried to, for lack of a better term, shove a square peg into a round hole when the scriptures are not intended to be a modern explanation of science. What we have instead in these opening couple of chapters of Genesis and the parallel material that we find in Moses chapters 2 and 3 and Abraham chapters 4 and 5 are really a Hebrew, an ancient Hebrew cosmology, one that was shared by the neighbors of the ancient Israelites. People in the ancient Near East had a very specific view of the universe and a view of the world and how things were constructed. According to the ancient Hebrews and the other people in who lived in their time, the earth was a flat disk, and the sky was a dome. What in Hebrew is the word there is rakia. That word has come to be translated in your King James Version in Genesis chapter 1, verse 6 as firmament. It's kind of an interesting word because the King James translators really didn't know how to translate the Hebrew word there, and so they punted and simply copied the word that was in the Latin Vulgate, firmamentum, which means an expanse, which is something firm. And this is the idea that was held by the ancients. You look up in the sky, and the sky is blue, and it goes all the way to the horizon, and you look up, and it's blue, and you go all the way to the other horizon, and it's blue, and it appears, for all intents and purposes, like a dome. And the objects in the sky, the sun and the moon and the stars, all appear to move across this dome. This is a geocentric view of the universe, one in which the earth is at the center and all the other things go around it. That was later replaced, of course, by a heliocentric view, which is one that is more compatible with what we understand, with the sun being at the center and the earth being a sphere and going around it. But that's not how it worked in the ancient world. And we actually see in the book of Abraham, and I think Stephen's going to talk in just a minute about some interesting perspectives on this from the book of Abraham, that the book of Abraham refers to the firmament as an expanse. It actually uses that word, that this is a large, solid object that sits above us, and that God is above the expanse. He dwells in the heavens, and that there are openings in the firmament through which he can cast down rain or other blessings. And so we see in the book of Malachi where the Lord says, "Pay your tithing, and I prove me now herewith if I will not open you the windows of heaven." And that's literally what the Hebrews understood, is that God was up there, and he could open the doors, and rain would come down or other blessings could be cast down upon the earth. The scriptures and the creation account tend to make more sense, I think, if we understand them and read them in their original perspective, and we don't try to force them into a modern view.
A couple of quick follow-ups, and then we'll turn the time over to Stephen. That is so accurate. If you try to force modern science on the Genesis account, you run into problems, not the least of which is that you have the Earth created before the stars and the rest of the solar system. You just can't do it. The appropriate way is to look at it from the point of view of the people who wrote the account, and that's just what Mike has said. The dome, the reference, is used in other Hebrew context as a brass bowl that was beat out with a hammer and turned upside down, and that was their model because that was something that they could see as part of their culture, and it described what they saw in the sky. So if we look at the details, the way they saw them and use their purposes, which would be to show that God's in charge of everything, the heavens and the earth as they saw it, as they understood it, were all created by God. That's the message of Genesis, and we shouldn't try to wrest it into modern science and try to get some MIT scholar in astronomy to somehow make them meld together. It's not going to happen.
And something that's important about that, Martin, before you go on, is how does this set the Hebrew account apart from their neighbors? The other cultures that lived in the ancient Near East viewed the objects in the sky, the sun and the moon and the stars, as gods, that these were divine, these were deities that traveled through the heavens. Or, you know, we're all familiar, of course, with the Egyptians and the sun god, Ra, etc., and he's crossing the sky in his solar bark. The Hebrew account is different in that it is very clear that God is not the sun, he's not the moon, he's not the stars. In fact, he created those things. And this is what sets the Hebrew people apart, that they are not to worship the false gods of their neighbors. God has created these lights in the sky, and they're there for to set times and seasons and mark out festivals, like when you know to celebrate Passover and so forth. That's why they exist, according to the Genesis account. They're not to be worshipped. That's an important point if you're an ancient Hebrew and you're living in a culture full of people who worship sun gods and moon gods and so forth.
Stephen.
Yes. So I have to agree with both you, Martin, as well as with Mike, that the book of Genesis, and I believe also the book of Abraham, reflects a pre-scientific and you would also say mythological understanding of the cosmos. Now, we don't like the term myth or mythology because when somebody says it's just a myth these days, they mean it's some sort of false story that somebody just made up. But the ancient concept of myth and a mythological language or mythological story was more in the sense of trying to situate mankind, in their relationship with the deities that they worshipped. So it wasn't necessarily just making stuff up out of thin air, but rather they're trying to show or they're trying to reflect your relationship, your position in the cosmos relative to the deity you're worshipping. And so in that sense, I believe the book of Abraham, like Genesis, is a mythological creation or an account of the creation. And there's a couple of things that tip me off to that. The first thing that's interesting about the book of Abraham cosmology is that you have this concept of the divine council. This is made really explicitly clear in Abraham 3, where you have the premortal council that comes together, and there's some sort of debate that arises, there's a crisis that arises. In the book of Abraham, it's over whose plan is going to be accepted. Of course, we know Lucifer has this plan, this course of action. The father has his own, and there's a debate that arises who's going to take care of this. And this is a hallmark that we see in other mythological accounts of the creation from other ancient Near Eastern societies. One of the more notable examples of this comes from the Babylonian, quote, creation account, the Enuma Elish. It's more than just a creation account, but a big part of the Enuma Elish is about the divine council of the gods of Babylon and the fact that there's this evil goddess Tiamat that wants to rule over the cosmos. And so the divine council comes together and they want to, all the gods come together and they want to create a solution to fight Tiamat. And a couple of gods go off and try to fight her, but they're not successful until Marduk comes along. He's a Babylonian god, and he says, I'll go fight Tiamat, and when I win, when I beat her, you'll make me the chief god. So he goes off and fights Tiamat, and he is actually able to, you know, conquer her, vanquish her. And I just want to read a couple of excerpts from the Enuma Elish. And this sort of dovetails with what Mike was talking about, this idea of a dome or of an expanse over the spherical earth. Listen to this wording from the Enuma Elish, where it says, "Valiant Marduk made firm his hold over Tiamat, whom he captured. The Lord trampled upon the frame of Tiamat. With his merciless mace, he crushed her skull. He opened the arteries of her blood, and he let the north wind bear it away as glad tidings." It's very grisly, right? But he destroys Tiamat, and then this is what he does with her. He says, "He split her in two, like a fish for dying. Half of her he set up and made a cover, or heaven, and the other half he stretched out and made the earth." And so we again see this understanding, this mythological conception, similar to the book of Genesis, as well as similar to the book of Abraham. You have these interesting convergences here. So that's an interesting convergence, is this idea of the divine counsel and creation out of this. Well, and this is going into my next point. The book of Abraham then goes on to talk about creation out of pre-existing matter. Specifically, this is chaotic matter. This is chaotic mass. It's usually personified as water, right? Since water is this weird, shapeless thing that you can't really control or, you know, get a hold of. So the ancient peoples of the ancient Near East understood this chaotic mass as being something like water. And what you have here is this water or this chaos needs to be conquered. It needs to be brought into order. It needs to be organized. It already exists. The gods haven't created this. It already exists. It needs to be ordered, though. And so what happens is the gods come down, and they have to fashion and order the cosmos. This is what Marduk is doing in the Enuma Elish. When he orders Tiamat, and from her spoiled carcass, he creates the cosmos. This is what's going on in Genesis, when it talks about the deep, or Tehom, which is the Hebrew cognate to Tiamat. God is ordering it or fashioning it. And this is also what happens in the book of Abraham. It's rather explicit when it says the gods, they say, "We will go down, for there is matter there, and we will organize it," and so forth. So, again, these interesting convergences. You have a premortal council that gets together. You have some sort of chaos that needs to be overcome. And then in order to... So, therefore, when you're creating something in the ancient Near East, you're not creating it ex nihilo, but rather you're organizing it. The verb bara in Hebrew, which is the word usually translated as to create, has the sense of manufacturing or fashioning something. It's not in the sense of creating it out of nothing or ex nihilo. That seems to be a rather late theological understanding of creation ex nihilo. The earliest I think we can pin it down is the Hellenic period, which is really, really late. So I find it interesting, again, to understand this not as a scientific depiction of the cosmos, but an ancient Near Eastern mythological depiction or understanding. This isn't to say, of course, that God did not create the universe. We all, of course, believe that he did. But rather, the language of the scriptures is not talking about E equals MC squared or anything like that. It's using mythological language that we see in other ancient Near Eastern cultures. So in that respect, I think it's pretty neat that the book of Abraham fits very, very nicely in this ancient Near Eastern cultural backdrop. And if we read it from that perspective, as Mike said, then we may, you know, avoid some of these awkward, you know, situations where we're trying to pigeonhole a non-scientific creation into a scientific worldview.
Well said. Thank you. Some great points. Jeff, let's turn the time over to you.
Yeah, I'd like to build on the points that you, Martin, and Mike, and Stephen talked about. And first of all, maybe talk a little bit about that opening phrase, "Let there be light." Maybe this builds directly on what Stephen said, because a lot of people, when the Big Bang Theory came along, said, of course, that's the Big Bang being talked about there. Other people have raised the idea that that might be the creation of the solar system. But in LDS thought, and I'll quote John Taylor in this regard, they realized that that light that was created at the very beginning, and of course the Big Bang even itself may not have been the beginning of all things. Current scientific thought is that that was that beginning of the universe that happened then might have been an ongoing, diachronic creation that continues even to this day. Creation of universes. John Taylor said this. He wrote that God caused light to shine upon the earth before the sun appeared in the firmament, for God is light and in him there is no darkness. And then he went on to quote D&C 88, which makes it clear that it's something over and above physical light is generally conceived. It's something that lightens our eyes, quickeneth our understandings. And interesting that Hebrew tradition takes that light one step further, asserting that the heavenly hosts that are variously described in ancient sources, including the angels, sons of God, and sometimes the souls of humanity, were part of that light described in connection with day one of creation. So we have God appearing in that world of spirits, as it were, and the rest of creation, who were also created at a time. And when the God divided the light from the darkness, from an LDS point of view, it's interesting to reflect on the traditions that talk about how that represents a premortal separation of spirits who rebelled from those who were light, the separation of light from darkness. We talked about that a little bit last week when we talked about in the Islamic tradition, you have Adam coming out of Adam, those spirits who were chosen who followed Muhammad, the spirits who were not chosen who followed Cain. You find Abraham talking about the great noble ones separated from the others. In the apocalypse of Abraham, we have the righteous and the wicked. So, again, that light from darkness, I assert, was maybe something closer to the spiritual creation, the creation of spirits, than creation of physical light. The building on what everybody said so far, I found it interesting that all the... We have four accounts of creation. We have each one teaches us something different. I'd say the one we receive outside of Scripture in the temple is probably the closest one, trying to give us some understanding of a more physical creation. But at Alma Abraham and Moses are presenting it in the context of Near Eastern thought. Some scholars have argued, just speaking specifically about the Book of Moses, that the architecture of the tabernacle and the temple is a similitude based on Moses' vision of creation. And according to this view, the results of each day of creation are symbolically reflected in temple furnishings and architecture. And that helps explain, for example, why the lights in the firmament aren't created till the fourth day. For example, as described in those sources, the light of day of creation might be understood as the light of glory of God and those who dwelled with him. Then the temple veil, the firmament, which is created next, would symbolize the firmament as the primary division between heaven and earth, again corresponding to the veil. Let me just read this quote by Lewis Ginsburg. He said, where he presents this point of view, God told the angels, on the first day of creation I shall make the heavens and stretch them out. So will Israel raise up the tabernacle as the dwelling place of my glory. So this, the whole creation is likened to a temple. On the second day, I shall put a division between the terrestrial waters and the heavenly waters. So will my servant Moses hang up a veil in the tabernacle to divide the holy place and the most holy being the first creation, that glory, that glorious light of God and those who are with him. On the third day, I shall make the earth to put forth grass and herbs. So will he, in obedience to my commandments, prepare shewbread before me. On the fourth day, I shall make the luminaries. So he will stretch out the golden candlestick, the menorah, before me. So again, that's why, according to this view, the luminaries didn't appear till the fourth day, because we're going from the inside, most holy place in the temple, to the outside, and the menorahs in the holy place. On the fifth day, I shall create the birds, so he will fashion the cherubim with outstretched wings. On the sixth day, continues Ginsburg, drawing the legends of the Jews, I shall create man, so will Israel set aside a man from the sons of Aaron as a high priest for my service. So that seventh day, in original thought, following this organization principle of the universe, to be a place, an abode fit for God to dwell, that seventh day then becomes the enthronement of God in his place of rest in the universe, what John Walton calls the control room of the universe in this temple-like creation. And Adam and Eve, who are dressed in some of the early art and in some of the early traditions as king and queen, are vice-regents. When it says to till and keep the garden, I guess we'll get into that more another time, but what they're really doing is made clear by the fact that the verbs for to till and to keep are the same ones that the Levites are being used for the Levites' duties in the temple. They're in essence asked to care for and do the work relating to the temple, just as the Levites later on do that. So I found this very compelling way to look at things. If you go to the Genesis Rabbah commenting on the raising of the Mosaic temple, it says, it is as if on that day, namely the day the tabernacle is raised in the wilderness, I actually created the world. So that's why Hugh Nibley and others have talked about the temple, a scale model of the universe. So when that creation is finished, when that similitude of the temple of the universe is created, God is enthroned, and when he is enthroned, the earth and the universe become a functional sanctuary, and creation then can become a temple because God is resting within it.
Some great points. Anyone have anything to add at this point to what Jeff has said?
I do very quickly. Going back to the Enuma Elish, I mentioned that it's not just a creation account. It's also an account on how Marduk, the chief god of Babylon, became the chief god of Babylon. And just as Jeff was talking about in the Hebrew conception, the crowning achievement of creation when God rests on the seventh day is him entering his temple, and it becomes his sort of command center, you might say. I think that's how Jeff described it. That's exactly what we see in the Enuma Elish. So let me read again one more little excerpt here. So after Marduk has conquered Tiamat and he's used her spoiled carcass to create the cosmos, the last thing he does before he becomes the chief god of Babylon is this. It says, below the firmament, whose grounding I made firm, a house I shall build. Let it be the abode of my pleasure. Within it I shall establish its holy place. I shall appoint my holy chambers. I shall establish my kingship. And then it goes on to say, I shall call it the name Babylon, meaning house of the great gods. And so it's also exactly, as Jeff was saying, an enthronement kingship text. And now, I failed to also mention to clarify this. What I'm not saying is that the Enuma Elish in Genesis and the Book of Abraham are all just sort of, you know, copying or plagiarizing each other, but rather to show that this is a very common understanding from the ancient world to view creation. You also have Egyptian texts of a similar nature, and so this is clearly the worldview that Genesis and Abraham, and I think also probably the Book of Moses, belongs to. And we can see this in this wonderful text, the Enuma Elish.
You know, for those who don't believe the gospel was taught in the beginning, that could be a real problem. You'd have to think of the Bible perhaps as being derivative. Mm-hmm. But whereas we believe the gospel was first taught to Adam and Eve, it becomes easier to understand how these are perhaps derivations, at least in some respects, of original ideas that were taught in the beginning.
Absolutely.
Great comment.
I wanted to make a few generalized comments here about science and religion, because someone listening may come to the conclusion that we have these sort of inferior views of the way things were actually created, because we have in the Genesis account things out of order from the way that they were originally created, and we have these ancient styles of description like a dome. And somehow science would be superior to that. I saw kind of an interesting description from Michio Kaku, who is a theoretical physicist at MIT, discussing recently, quite candidly, the major problems that science has today. And not the least of which is that if you take a look at what science will tell you about the age of the entire universe, it would be somewhere around 14 billion years, depending on which particular scientist you're talking to. Whereas you talk to astronomers, and they will tell you that based on redshift with stars, that the oldest stars in the universe are between 16 and 18 billion years old. So science, modern science on the cutting edge, has the same problems that the Genesis account does. It can't quite account for things in the right order. It's impossible for the stars to have been formed before the entire universe, which holds them, and yet that's where you are. You have some similar problems with paleontology and in evolution, Darwin's earlier theories were discarded because they just didn't work with the fossil record, and you wound up with punctuated equilibria theory, that Niles Eldridge formed. And so what you have is a situation where religion's understanding progresses over time, and so does scientific points of view about the way things are created. And what those show is that people, at least at our stage of development, are really incapable of understanding everything about the creation. We just have the most rudimentary details about it. And the main points, the most important points about the creation, I think in some major ways, were solved by Joseph Smith's approach, which seems to me to be very, very inspired. When you talk about creation out of pre-existing matter, you also have a solution to the problem of evil. If you take the position that happens, as Stephen pointed out, in Hellenistic times in the second century, is about the earliest we can trace it, as you said, then you have to say, well, God created everything out of nothing, and part of what he created is evil. And how can that be? How can God actually create evil? If you have God working with pre-existing materials, including pre-existing intelligence and spirit, then you could have God dealing with evil in an appropriate way, especially as the Book of Mormon talks about, and having good and evil juxtaposed against each other so that people can learn and grow and progress. And all of those things are possible when you have the approach that Joseph Smith took, which to me is a great testimony to the inspired nature of his Genesis accounts as they're brought to us in the Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham.
Martin, can I jump in here for just a minute?
Please.
I think that the conflict that so many people have between science and religion, particularly as it's seen here in the creation account, is really a false one and an unnecessary one. What we have are two different approaches that are trying, that are asking different questions and coming to different conclusions and telling different stories. On the one hand, you have science that is using measurable observations to determine how are planets formed, how are stars formed, how large is the universe, how old is the universe, and those sorts of questions. The scriptures and the biblical creation account, on the other hand, are asking a completely separate set of questions. And those questions are, what is God's relationship to man? What is God's relationship to creation? What is God's relationship to animals? And what are our obligations as human beings with regard to the rest of creation? Science doesn't tell us anything about what is our obligation as human beings to the creation. The Genesis account and the parallel accounts that we have in Moses and Abraham and in the temple tell us very clearly that we are stewards and that we are responsible for these creations, that God has placed us above these things, but that doesn't mean that we can abuse them. It means that we are to care for them and to use them wisely and to manage them. So these are completely separate questions that are being asked, and I don't think that anyone should feel necessary to try and come up with some sort of grand unifying theory. These are two stories, two approaches, asking different questions, getting different answers. And they may or may not be complementary, but we don't have to talk about them in the same breath. We can very comfortably talk about science in one forum and then go to another and talk about the creation accounts that we have in the scriptures.
You know, Mike, I agree with you on what you're saying. There are a few touch points, though, where the scriptures seem to rule out scientific explanations. I just want to touch on one of those because it is important, I think, misconception. For example, D&C 77:6 refers to the earth during the 7,000 years of its continuance or its temporal existence. That seems a very straightforward, even though the general concerns in which that revelation is embedded, that seems a very straightforward touch point, but where science and religion may be seen to conflict. And so some people, even the LDS Church today, believe that we have to then adhere to a time timeline on Earth's creation that's 7,000 years, a young Earth, as that's called. I just wanted to point out that the early brethren, and even some of the modern brethren, didn't feel that that constrained us to that time frame. Lorenzo Snow reports that Joseph Smith and others, including William W. Phelps, were discussing the age of the Earth at one evening, and they started doing some speculating and talking about things, which ended up with a figure that we have from a record of William W. Phelps, which was an Earth that was billions of years old. Now, it wasn't within, you know, the exact range of what science believes the Earth was today, but it certainly was far different than 100,000 years to millions of years that was thought in the 19th century. So even in the time of Joseph Smith, that 7,000 years in DNC 77 was not thought to constrain the age of the Earth, and they came up with a way of understanding that that was consistent with their view. I'll point out that even Elder Bruce R. McConkie in our day said the same thing. He said, what is a day, a specified time period, an age, an eon, a division of eternity? And he went on and also gave his view that the Earth was billions of years old, consistent with Brother Phelps. So even on those touch points where we think we might be constrained, those few touch points, I should say, because in most areas, science and religion have complementary perspectives, I think we don't have to reject science.
You know, that's a great point. The devil's in the details, or in this particular case, how you decide to define your terms. And if you define temporal age of the Earth as in the day that it came into being, then you might have some kind of a direct conflict with modern science. But if temporal age of the Earth is a reference to the time that our lineage and our people are here on the Earth, then you really don't have a conflict. And I think defining the details is really important, similar to the ex nihilo issue. If you look at the scriptures like Hebrews 11:3, you can easily read that to, oh, God created everything out of nothing. And if you look at it from the other perspective, then it's a great scripture, just like the obscure one in Maccabees that I'm not going to remember, that talks about creation. And some people see that and they go, aha, out of nothing, and others say out of pre-existing matter. So often it's in the eyes of the beholder how these things are viewed. One of the most important concepts here, though, for Latter-day Saints about the creation is the gist of the basic points of our lesson here, and that is we are not to worry, and we are to understand that God is in charge, that He has created everything, and that unlike we might infer from some modern science, we are really important as human beings in the scope of God's creation, that many of His creations are for our good. Why? Because we are of the lineage of God, and unlike we hear in many Jewish trains of thought and in Protestant concepts and Catholic as well, where there's this great unbridgeable gulf between God and man, and we can never really understand God, and we will never ever be like Him. We have this idea in LDS thought that we are gods in embryo, and that we are here doing our small amounts of creation in this life, and that God derives joy and happiness and pleasure from helping us along this path, line upon line, precept upon precept of eternal progression, and that ultimately we can literally become like our divine parents, just as our children, as they grow and progress, can become like us. And as we all hope, good people in choosing the right path. And those are some of the main points that this whole idea of creation brings out, and they should be reassuring to us and helpful to us that we are God's children and that God has created all of this for our good and benefit. Other thoughts that any of you gentlemen would like to add here as well? Okay, we have spent as much time as we probably need to tonight. We'll sign off and say that has...
Wait. I'm not ready to sign off. I just thought you had some comments on that thing.
Good. Okay. All right. My fault.
I've got a few things to say, too, so let's...
Good. I'm totally misread that silence. Go ahead, Jeff. And then we'll go to Mike and anybody else who wants to say anything as well.
Well, you know, Stephen, you haven't spoken for a while. Are you itching to say anything?
Nothing that's super important, so I'll let you say whatever. You seem pretty adamant that you had something you really wanted to talk about, so I'll let you have the point first.
Okay, we got to leave time for Mike, though, too.
You and Mike go first. Yeah.
We'll leave plenty of time for everyone.
I wanted to just touch on another important touch point in the creation story, and that is the creation of man. Like, they're one of the few touch points that becomes a worry for people is how that took place. And, you know, there are some scriptures that, even though we're taught in the church that the creation of man, is, as it's been given to us in some accounts, is only figurative. And hearing that Joseph Smith changed that verse in the Joseph Smith translation to
Jeff,
say who was formed of God.
Let me jump in. Jeff,
it's interesting also that the most recent prophet...
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Jeff, maybe you could repeat that. You sort of phased out there for a second.
Oh, did I fade out?
I don't want people to miss that concept.
Sorry.
Yes.
Okay. So some of the scriptures that are cited to in defense of the view that... Of a special creation of man, let's call it. Look at, say, a scripture like in the beginning of Mark where it talks about the genealogy of Jesus Christ. It says, Adam, who was the son of God. It's interesting to note that when Joseph Smith went through and revised the Bible, he specifically said, Adam, who was formed of God. And so it's interesting that Joseph Smith felt compelled to maybe clarify that in some ways. The most recent modern prophet to specifically address the creation of man was President Spencer W. Kimball as a sitting prophet. He said the following, I'll just quote, "The creators breathed into their nostrils the breath of life, and man and women became living souls. We don't know exactly how their coming into this world happened, and when we're able to understand it, the Lord will tell us." So I take that to mean that we don't have to rule out what science says. We don't have to have a specific modus operandi that people have speculated on for the creation of man. I think we can feel free to understand and explore those things and prepare ourselves for when the Lord is going to tell us more. I'll just say something, one more thing, and then I'll close. And I'd really like to hear more from some of the others. There's really three dimensions of resemblance between God and man when we talk about man in the image and likeness of God. The one, of course, is physical resemblance. And when the LDS scripture says Adam was created in the image of God's own body, Prophet Joseph Smith, the King Follett sermon, I think it was, said that if the veil were rent today and you would see God in all the person, image, and fashion, the very form of a man like yourselves, for Adam was formed in his likeness and created in the very fashion and image of God. Striking thought, and thought to be heretical by most Christians. However, that was a concept in early Judaism, early Christianity. There's a great story in Genesis Rabbah that says Adam's likeness, when Adam was created, it said that Adam's likeness to God was so exact that Adam had to be put to sleep so that the angels might worship the right person, that they wouldn't worship God and Adam instead of God. And so that's just a powerful image there. And then the other affirmation, the second way in which we're in the image and likeness of God, is in terms of our potential. Again, the notion of Mormonism is thought to be heretical in the sense of having the potential to become like God. This is also an ancient idea. The Orthodox Church has a very famous formulation where they say, God became man in order that man might become God. They have a little different interpretation today than they did in the early days, but it's quite a clear statement how it stands. the great theologian C.S. Lewis, who is so quoted by many modern Christians, said this: the Son of God became a man in order to enable man to become sons of God. That's not just C.S. Lewis, though. That's all through scriptures. We find that concept. Jesus himself said, I would that you may become perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. That just goes right over the heads of most believers in Jesus Christ, but it's very clear teaching. The third area, of course, is the notion that God is our Father. Jesus called God Father in his prayers. He was very pointed to use that form of address and to teach his apostles. He used the word Abba, an Aramaic word for Father, in his prayers, depicting that closeness that he felt with his fathers. Paul taught that we're the offspring of God. And so in every respect, the scriptures teach, when it teaches the creation of man, no matter how it exactly occurred, that we have this image in which we are created, and we have the potential to come to his likeness. And I am so grateful, in sort of concluding my part of this session, to know and to belong to a church that embraces the vision of science, that embraces the Bible, that embraces continuing revelation, and this vision of man's potential, which I believe is breathed through all of Scripture, about man's great potential to become as our Heavenly Father literally is. I'm grateful for that.
Well said. Mike.
Well, I wish that there was a way to segue from what Jeff just said and how elegant and how eloquent he said it, and I completely agree with him. Unfortunately, what I wanted to talk about is actually somewhat of a backtrack and a completely different topic, so this is going to sound like a rough transition, and I apologize for that, Jeff, because what you said was absolutely wonderful, and I agree with you completely. I wanted to go back just a little bit and talk about, we've discussed the creation accounts, and we've mentioned that there are four that we have as Latter-day Saints: the Genesis account, the Book of Moses, which is the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis, the Book of Abraham, and then, of course, the Temple. But contained within three of those accounts, and those are the scriptural ones, we actually find two separate creation stories. The first one appears, and I'll use the Genesis reference here, but it also shows up in Moses and Abraham. The first account appears in Genesis, starting with chapter 1, verse 1, and continues through chapter 2, verse 3. And this represents the creation taking place over 6 days. So we have, in order, we have light. We have on day 2, sea and sky. And then on day 3, we have land and plants. Then we have heavenly bodies. We have fish and birds. And then on the 6th day, we have land animals and finally man. And then on the 7th day, of course, very famously, right at the beginning of Genesis chapter 2, that God finished these things. Everything is very good, and he rests from his labors. And then suddenly, the account shifts. We get to Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, and we get a completely separate secondary account. In this case, there's no division of creation into units of time. It doesn't mention days. It does have an order, though, and the order is different than what we had in the first one. And this continues, by the way, from chapter 2, verse 4, to the end of chapter 2, verse 25. So the order of creation here, and it's not in days, but there is an order. It talks about the heavens and the earth being created, and then a water comes up in a mist form and waters the face of the earth. Man is created as step 3. Then the Garden of Eden is created, and then we have land animals and birds, and then on the sixth and final creation is woman. The temple account doesn't break these two up. It tends to sort of integrate them in the sense that you have man being created and then he's introduced into the garden and so forth. But in the written scriptural accounts, the transition is very stark. And in fact, with chapter 2, verse 4 of Genesis, it begins with the phrase, "These are the generations," which is a common phrase that we see in the Old Testament when there is a completely new narrative that begins. Now, some Latter-day Saints, and I'm going to name names here. I think this starts with B.H. Roberts. It gets picked up by Cleon Skousen. Some Latter-day Saints have theorized that there's a way to reconcile these two accounts. that one represents a so-called spiritual creation, and the other is a natural creation, with natural meaning physical. And the basis for this comes from a passage in Moses chapter 3, verse 5, where it says, and this is unique to the Joseph Smith translation, it's not found in the Genesis account, where it says, "For I, the Lord God, created all things of which I have spoken spiritually before they were naturally upon the face of the earth." And so the theory goes that this first creation must be some type of a planning phase, that God planned out all these things, and we see it in 7 days, and then in the second phase, he actually comes and he does it. The problem is that it doesn't work, that theory. The material, and the reason why it doesn't work, is that the material in the second account, it doesn't parallel the material in the first. It's a completely separate account, and there are some other unique features that we don't have time to go into here. Also, note that Moses chapter 3, verse 5 doesn't say physically. It says naturally. And that may sound like a minor point, but it actually, I think, is an important one, because it parallels the way that the Apostle Paul uses those words, spiritual and natural, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 44. He's talking about the resurrection there, and he says that the resurrection is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. In other words, it is sown a mortal body, and it is raised a spiritual or a perfected immortal body. So it seems to me that Moses chapter 3, verse 5, what it is really talking about is that the Lord created the earth in an immortal or spiritual perfect form, and then later it fell and became a mortal or natural form. I think that interpretation tends to work better with Moses chapter 3, verse 5. So in conclusion of this thought here, it seems to me that the difference between these two creation accounts that we find is actually better explained as a combining of two ancient textual sources, that we have two separate creation stories or myths, as Stephen used that term, that were at some point put together by an editor or a redactor. The documentary hypothesis, which we don't have time to go into here, actually theorizes that the Old Testament has been put together, or at least the books of Moses have been put together from accounts that were written by various people at different times, and then later an editor or redactor put them together. That seems to work a little bit better here. In conclusion, I would just point out that it's important to remember that these creation stories are, as has been mentioned here several times, symbolic, metaphorical, mythological. They represent an understanding of how we are to see ourselves in the light of our relationship to God. And so it's perfectly fine, at least from my point of view, to see two separate creation accounts that approach it from a different aspect, because we learn different things from each one of them, different important spiritual truths.
Mike, could I make a comment building on what you said? I'm so glad you made those points. I guess, you know, we find that some people really have difficulty with the idea that there were multiple editors involved in the Old Testament and other parts of Scripture. And I guess, to me, if I think about it, this is exactly what the Book of Mormon is. Mm-hmm. The editors there explicitly say that they wove together accounts from various editors who wrote much larger accounts, and that in many cases they were likening the scriptures to themselves. They were weaving the accounts in a way that brought home the teaching point that they wanted to do. So anyone who might, you know, feel uncomfortable with the idea that there may have been multiple sources woven together into this beautiful account, actually I think in most cases they're beautifully woven together, you know, maybe you could reflect on the way Revelation came in the Book of Mormon and other places where we have explicit accounts of those. Of course, in the Old Testament, we don't know if all the editors were working under the same inspiration that Mormon was, and we don't have explicit accounts of how those things were put together. But to me, it really does not provide any consternation, and it's something, again, another area where scholarship and our faith ought not to collide.
Thank you. I completely agree.
Great point. Stephen, did you have something else you wanted to add?
Just a few things. I know it's getting a little late, so I'll try to be fast here. I wish we had more time to talk about what Mike brought up with these two different sources being redacted together, and the documentary hypothesis and what that sort of entails, because that's a very fruitful and interesting area. So maybe in a future roundtable we can do that. But one thing that I just wanted to mention briefly, as I've looked at, okay, so let me preface this with something. Hugh Nibley, in one of his books on the Book of Abraham, talked about how for the longest time, a lot of individuals have made a big fuss over the Joseph Smith papyri and the fragments that they received in the 1960s, and there's been big controversy over that. And everybody's been worried about how Joseph Smith translated the Book of Abraham. And Hugh Nibley said that's certainly an important issue, but what's more important, or at least what's equally important, is to look at the content of the Book of Abraham itself and to judge the content of the Book of Abraham against what we know about the ancient Near East. And as I've looked at the creation account in the Book of Abraham, and as I've compared it to not only the Enuma Elish, which I quoted tonight, but some other ancient Near Eastern creation mythologies, I'm absolutely blown away at how ahead of the curve Joseph Smith was, so to speak, in recapturing and restoring this ancient cosmological understanding of a divine council, of creation from pre-existing chaotic matter, of the points we've touched on tonight. To me, I think it's an absolutely wonderful testimony builder to look at the wonderful cosmology Joseph Smith gave us, not just in the Book of Abraham, but also what he goes on to give us in the Temple Endowment, which I believe is fairly obviously was largely drawn from the Book of Abraham. To see Joseph Smith saying things like in 1844, he's saying that creation involves organizing matter. Before scholars had any idea about the Enuma Elish or these other ancient Near Eastern mythological creation stories where this is exactly what happens, you organize matter. For Joseph Smith to say this is absolutely remarkable. And so whether he was actually translating an ancient Abrahamic text or whether he was receiving pure revelation and restoring this ancient material, to me is really sort of besides the point. I'm absolutely convinced that this is a beautiful recapturing of this ancient cosmological understanding, going back, as Jeff has pointed out, going back as early as Adam, and how fortunate we are as Latter-day Saints to have these wonderful new materials in the Book of Abraham, in the Book of Moses, and in the Temple. And I would also like to say very briefly that I agree with Jeff when he says we shouldn't be afraid of when scholarship or when science in our faith may seem to clash or contradict. Usually that contradiction or that clash may come from certain assumptions we have that need to be rechecked. There may be certain details that we've missed that we need to take another look at. Most of the things, not everything, I'm not saying that this is like a, slam dunk, everything, closed case, so to speak, but most of these issues that people bring up that I've seen that have, some sort of troubled faith or some sort of questions about, I think if you sit down and look at it really carefully, you can see some very beautiful answers that tend to harmonize and find supporting answers to these sorts of questions. And that includes the documentary hypothesis. That's why I wish we had time to go more, in it more in depth, but maybe that'll be a teaser for another time. So those are my last two bits, I suppose, is how wonderful, how blessed we are to have this wonderful Book of Abraham and Book of Moses that very much restores this ancient cosmology. And if there ever is a seeming contradiction between religion and science, my advice would be to quote Henry Eyring when he said, "Is there a conflict between religion and God? Well, maybe in the minds of man, but not in the mind of God." And so we should be careful and have patience and continue to study these things, and I'm convinced that ultimately we'll find answers or at least begin to have better understanding of these issues.
Well said. And on that note, let me thank our participants tonight, Jeff Bradshaw, Mike Parker, Steve Smoot. Wonderful job, gentlemen, and thank you for your contribution to this Interpreter Foundation Roundtable Number 3 on the creation. Join us again next time for another roundtable broadcast.